Broadcasting live from the San Diego Marriott Marquis and Marina, it's CEO Exclusive. Now here's your hosts, Mark Borelli and Soini Koch.
Well, morning, everyone. It's great to be here at the Marriott Marquis in San Diego, broadcasting live from Vistage's Executive Summit. My name is Soini Koch, and I'm glad to have Mark Borelli here as my co-host. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Soini. It's wonderful to be here. Great San Diego weather as well. It should be a great event today.
Yeah. So I would love to introduce our first guest who's going to be with us this morning, Stefan Arsel, and he is the CEO and founder of Tower Paddleboards. Stefan, it's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so as always, we're going to ask you the CEO exclusive question, which is what are the trends in your industry or area of expertise that you think other middle market CEOs would be interested in? So what do you think? What's going on with paddleboards these days?
Well, we're a paddleboard company. We're more sort of a beach lifestyle company. So all products, you know, retail is really what we're in, but direct-to-consumer retail. And I think obviously the big trend there is that, you know, retail is going through this massive sea change. I heard just yesterday, like Sports Authority and Sports Chalet here locally in San Diego, you know, we're just going out of business. They weren't like, you know, shifting their business. 57 years, they just said, we're just quitting.
Sports Authority is going out of business.
And Sports Chalet. You
know, wow.
Like 55 stores and online, and they decided not to change their business model, but just shut it down. So e-commerce is, you know, sort of really taking over, and these direct-to-consumer brands are sort of the, you know, where retail is going.
So go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, as you think about that, that's one of the things that's been coming up a lot in my conversations lately with CEOs is this notion of disruption, right? Companies, you know, what's the statistic that like half the companies that were on the Fortune 500 20 years ago are gone or something like that? And so what are your, like, how are you thinking about disruption? Would you consider yourself in the position of being a disruptor?
Yeah, I think definitely. And I think those numbers, like you're talking about there, like the companies that are on the Fortune 500, it used to be those would swap, you know, every 25 years, and then it was 15 years. Now it's 10 years. So it's really accelerating. So the pace you go into business and can be taken out of business are, you know, accelerating to a huge degree. You know, we came into the paddleboard industry, and there were 80 brands in there. And the industry is growing, but you know, we're basically growing by eating market share from other people. So we're definitely, we came in there, did a direct-to-consumer model, and, you know, disrupted the rest of the, you know, the industry.
So in competing for, you know, taking share from others in the direct-to-consumer model, what do you think has been the key in getting your brand message out there?
Well, you got to approach it from a different manner. You can't do the same thing that everybody else is doing. So we sort of changed the business model where we sell direct to consumers, where everybody else was selling through this three-tier distribution strategy, and that allowed us to sell prices at basically half the cost. You know, we're making from the exact same manufacturers. I mean, they were so cheap that it was literally hard to get our point across that this is the same quality product because price is such a huge indicator of quality. But then we also, you know, went in there with a different marketing strategy. We didn't advertise for the first 3 years. And I think you'll see a lot of the best companies in the world today are not advertising. So what they're doing is they're having like this value proposition or this product that is so over the top that they don't have to advertise. And if they can't find that great value proposition, they're not going into business. They're not starting. So, you know, the Facebook or a company like Tesla, Google, these companies have never advertised. And so that's what you've got to do. You've got to find something that's so over the top that it, you know, people will tell other people about it. Mm-hmm. And so that gave us a huge marketing advantage. You know, we get, you know, probably 50,000 unique visitors coming to our website a month, and we don't pay a dime for that because we're, you know, optimized for the search engines, where our competitors are paying, you know, probably on the order of, you know, $250,000 to $500,000 a year to get that same exposure. We get that for free. That gives you a massive, you know, marketing advantage to start. And, you know, for a company like mine, we were starting with no money. So you sort of have to figure out a hack.
And just to follow up on that, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about, quote, the development of like the tribe that surrounds a product or a brand. You know, when I think about this, you know, Apple's the classic, but people like Patagonia and any of these products, do you find that's developing in your industry? User groups are forming, people talking offline, not through channels you've created, but just creating their own channels to discuss your products and
definitely. Definitely, yeah. You've got to tap into those, you know, discussion groups where that was sort of the early form on the internet. And I mean, that's 10 or 15 years old. But now you have Facebook groups and stuff like that. But a lot of companies like mine, you know, we're creating our own media. Like we started a magazine, basically a beach lifestyle magazine called Tower Magazine. And we don't even talk about paddleboards on there. We just talk about anything that would be interesting to our tribe, as you say. And we're growing the audience of that. Right now we have a subscriber base of about 40,000 people. We've got a full-time video maker on staff. We've got one person running the magazine. So it's a two-person show. But, you know, we just posted a video the other day. It got 12,000 views. It got like 500 social shares. And we're really able to make a dent. And the idea here is that, you know, long-term, we're in the paddleboard business. That could be a trending, you know, business or segment that disappears at some point. And if that disappears, it's like we want to still have that audience. So we're going to grow this online magazine to about 500,000 people over the next 2 to 3 years. And then that will be the stability in our business. We will sort of own the media.
You'll own the relationship. So a couple questions that I have that are really interesting are, well, how do you know that you have a hit? So, you know, Facebook, and you didn't have to advertise, and neither did it, you know, Instagram or Uber. But going into something, how do you actually know that you have a value proposition that's that compelling?
Sure. Are people willing to pay for it? Are they willing to give you their time in exchange for it? So the idea of Kickstarter, like a lot of people look at Kickstarter as, you know, this fundraising, a way to raise money. Well, I look at that completely different, and I think a lot of people do. It's really proof of concept. So you put the something up on Kickstarter. If you can get, you know, $20,000 or $100,000 in real money that people are committing to this product, you have a product. If you can't, you know, you shouldn't start that. So by going to Kickstarter first, instead of, you know, going and getting a patent, you know, throwing a huge, you know, team behind a company, a big marketing budget and these huge elaborate plans, and then launch your product, and then you're going to find out whether that, you know, succeeds or fails. I think that's kind of how they did it in sort of old school business, did it that way, because I think you could literally push through things that weren't great value propositions. If you had a huge, you know, powerful brand, they had this model. You create a product that's good enough, you put it out there, and then you just surround it with marketing, and it will become a market share, you know, leader, or at least competitive. I think it's getting harder and harder to do that, because these really truly great value propositions and truly great products are, you know, they're not having to spend the same money to get to those people, and so they have this sort of, you know, distinctive advantage. So another thing there is that, like with my paddleboard company, the reason I started a paddleboard company, I mean, a buddy took me out paddleboarding, but I looked at the search engine results. You know, I looked how many people are searching for paddleboards, and there was just this huge demand of people searching for paddleboards online. And there wasn't anybody meeting that demand. So and you can tell just by what people search what demand is and where there is demand and where there is not demand. I've started other businesses where I didn't do that process, and those ones fail. Every business that I've started where I sort of proved demand up front, and it wasn't this guessing game, and then you just sort of, you know, architect a better value proposition than what's out there.
It's interesting you talk about Kickstarter. Just as I always tell CEOs that I work with, can you describe your business and why somebody should be interested in it, like a Kickstarter promotion video? And I find most of them, that's a challenge they forget after a while. They started it like that, but they lose it after time, and it's a good focus to have, I think.
I believe that you were the fastest growing company, according to the San Diego Journal, or Business Journal, last year. Is that right?
In 2014.
Oh, 2014.
Last year, we were number 15.
Oh, my God. Only down to number 15.
The shame.
I know. The shame of it.
Last year we made the Inc. 500 for the first time ever. So, and we were number 239 in the nation.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Definitely.
So,
and the interesting thing about that is when we won that award, they were counting
which
down.
Which one? Because there's a bunch now.
the fastest growing in San Diego.
Yeah.
And they were counting down from 100. And it was at this big event in San Diego. And we thought we were going to be in the top 10 because we knew our growth numbers. And we could see historical years, like where that would place us. And they started counting down. And they went 3, didn't name us. 2, didn't name us. We were like, holy cow, we just won this thing. And I went up to speak, and I didn't even have like a suit on or anything. I really wasn't expecting it.
It's brand consistent.
We're a surf company, right?
Yeah, so it's
and
brand consistent.
All
That's
of
good.
These, but all of these other businesses there were very like serious. Like nobody takes a surf company seriously. And the fact that we won that, I think, raised a few eyebrows in the room. It's like, you know, what's going on here? This company, at the time, we had 5 people in our company. We were going to do $5 million that year. That just shows you how much the world has changed. Like, you can have these sort of very highly, I guess, you know, efficient companies these days. It's totally changed.
Mm-hmm. And I know that Shark Tank was a big part of your story as well. So if you would just want to walk us through, was Shark Tank, you think, the thing that catapulted you, that allowed you to start to get on the really fast growth trajectory?
Yeah, Shark Tank definitely helped. And when I went on Shark Tank, I'm actually known as the worst pitch in the history of Shark Tank that actually got a deal. And so I, like, you know, went silent on air. All the sharks were making fun of me. I got called a nerd. I got called a leprechaun. Three of them went out immediately. But then I ended up coming back, and I got a deal with Mark Cuban. And it was $150,000 for 30% of our company. And then he also negotiated for first right of refusal to invest in any company I do in the future, which was a first on Shark Tank. So he was sort of investing in me. That was in 2011 was when we filmed it. It aired in 2012. You know, our revenue growth in 2011, we did $260,000. In 2012, we did $1.7 million. So that was sort of the initial Shark Tank effect. But really, being on the show wasn't the, you know, what pushed our revenues. It was the media we got around being on the show. A lot of people go on Shark Tank, and there's this huge wave of traffic. You know, but it's about 4 days, you're on TV, and a lot of the people that go on that show think, okay, I'm on Shark Tank, you know, I'm a millionaire, this is a done deal. But the reality of it is, it's a wave that washes over most of these small companies, and they can't even absorb most of that, you know, the media, or generate the sales from it. So we just went out and got a bunch of, you know, articles and news stuff. And what happened with us, because we're a search engine optimization company, we were looking to get links back to our site. So our traffic before that was about 300 users per day coming to our site, and after it, it was 1,000, and then it was a change, and then it just went up from there. So really, the media push was what we benefited from Shark Tank. I think, you know, the way we did our business in paddleboards, I've done this before in the poker chip segment, and we became a market share leader there too. But I think Shark Tank, what it is, it advanced us like 2 or 3 years.
Wow. And do you still find that people remember the Shark Tank thing when you?
You know, I get a little bit of that. I had someone come here and recognize me just today. It's kind of weird, but certainly not famous by any means.
Well, the theme, we're at the Vistage Executive Summit, and the theme of today is bold leadership. And so I'm wondering, as you think about your organization and the people who work for you, like, what's your approach to leadership and being bold in your leadership?
So here's something interesting we're doing. And this we did this about a year ago.
This is We Tower Paddleboards?
We Tower Paddleboards, yeah.
Okay.
And there was seven of us at the time, I think. We switched the whole company to a five-hour workday. So working 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. straight through. We don't have lunch. And we just compressed the workday. And this was something that, you know, myself and a lot of entrepreneurs that I know are doing. They're, you know, they're not really working the traditional, you know, 40-hour work week. They're coming in, they're working at a high speed, and then they're getting out of there and going and living their lives. Now, as a beach lifestyle company, this is our brand.
And living in San Diego with this fabulous weather overlooking the marina, I could see why you'd want to do that.
And our offices are about a block from the beach, and we said, wait a minute, like, we're a surf company. Why are we, you know, we're this high growth company. We've proved we can do that. But are we really being, you know, true to our brand? And I sort of personally believe there's this...
Can I come work for you?
Sure. We are hiring. So I think there's this collective delusion. And this is knowledge workers, right? And I think a good knowledge worker in today's world is getting 2 to 3 hours of good work done. But we're staying in the office on average like 9.5 hours. I mean, we're not even working 40 hours. We're working a lot longer.
Yeah.
And it's going longer and longer. And it's this sort of badge of courage and how long you can stay in the office. But that has no relation to how effective you are. And especially in today's world with all of these productivity tools, I think a lot of people aren't using these because they don't have to. So what we're doing is just how, like in a startup, if you compress a startup for money, they find creative solutions.
Right.
If you compress something for time, same thing. You're going to find productivity tools. You're going to find the stuff that was already there that you haven't found. And I'm actually writing a book called The 5-Hour Workday. And it's going to be released in about 2 months.
All right. Well,
excellent. Look forward to that.
Yeah. And so how are people doing? Are they really getting the work done in 5 hours?
It's it's an adjustment. I think some people, it stresses them out. Like, there's definitely this pressure. They stop doing a lot of the stuff like, you know, Facebook or, you know, shopping online
Which
or their fantasy football.
Which they should have been doing anyway.
Yeah, but bosses really don't care because productivity is not off. Productivity is still up. You know, the net game is still up. But if you compress that, some people get a little nervous, you know, and it's a baseline. So, you know, I'll still work a 60-hour week on occasion. And I tell everybody, you know, in my team, it's like, you know, if you weren't producing then, you're not producing now, you will get fired. Like, if you need to work 10 hours a day to compete with everybody else that works here, you know, you have to do that. But if you can work at this high rate, you know, and you want to just walk out the door at 1 o'clock, everybody is happy.
Now, do you find many people, even though they're walking out the door, still working at home or whatever?
Well, exactly. And we all are, whether we're on the, you know, the traditional, you know, 40, 50 hour work week. That's the thing with knowledge work. Now, you have no downtime. You know, you have this cell phone that you're walking around with. People are always answering their emails, you know, on the weekend. And really, sort of the assembly line of today is information flow. And if you stop that, if you really take a 3-day weekend, you know, you've slowed stuff down a lot. But if you can just sort of, you know, answer an email on a Saturday, get a response on a Sunday, move it forward Sunday night, you've actually done work, you know. And so everybody is expected to do this now. And we're working, you know, 47 hours a week on average. 25% of the nation is working more than 60 hours a week. And you're taking stuff home. And so it's, and we're massively more productive too. So if you look at the last 40 years, productivity has gone up on average for a worker in America. This isn't just knowledge workers. Productivity has gone up 80%. Wages have gone up 11%. And if you look at a knowledge worker, they're probably, you know, 200-300 times more productive just because of the productivity tools we have. All of this money is going to the top. And that's why we're having this, you know, separation of classes. So really what the 5-hour workday is sort of a renegotiation. Okay, we're going to give you this compressed workday. We're going to, you're going to be making more dollars per hour, but you're going to have to work faster. So this is trying to solve a couple problems. One is sort of a workforce that's trained to be lazy, basically, trained to spend their entire lives in the office. And it's not making us, you know, happy and healthy as a society. And it's not making us productive either.
Yeah, and I think, you know, from what you've said also, the gap, even if they do take time off, what I have found is people who take time, more of a break from work, end up making better decisions because they're not so blinded by the noise.
Yeah, I mean, there's another thing we rolled out at the same time we rolled out this 5-hour workday. We did profit sharing. So basically everybody's salary per hour almost doubled. But we did other stuff, like we have this daily gratitude blog where everybody has to say 3 things they're grateful for every day. Because in the knowledge working world, you know, happiness is the new productivity tool. If you have, you know, someone that's going through a breakup in your office, you guys have probably seen this. I mean, this person is a train wreck. They're not getting anything done for weeks at a time, right? So you're sort of managing your energy level. If you have people that are, you know, working out or something like that, that makes you more productive in the office. There's all of these things that you should be doing that we really don't have time for in our sort of work-obsessed world where we're working, we're coming home and sleeping, we're making more money to buy the bigger house. It's this sort of, you know, collective hamster wheel we've got on, and I think we need an adjustment. And a lot of people are talking about this, you know, the sort of this shift in work-life balance.
Okay, so your new book, last question. So your new book is coming out when?
It's coming in about 2 months.
Okay, great. Well, we will look forward to that, and it's called The 5-Hour Workday.
Yep.
Well, right. Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the show with us, Stefan.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Stefan. It was really interesting.
This show is brought to you by Annona Enterprises, where strategy is your access to money and performance. Learn more at annonaenterprises.com.